Right, David Moore, Astronomy Ireland, how are you keeping today? Thank you very much for joining me.
Very well, thanks.
So we're here to talk about your baby, Astronomy Ireland, and a few other little things. Tell me, how did you found, or how did you get an interest in astronomy?
Well, for me, I wanted to blow things up. So as a kid, I was interested in explosions and explosives and wanted to get a chemistry set for Christmas. And a friend of mine at school, I think I was about 10 or 11, had a chemistry set. So one lunchtime, we went home to have a look at it. And sure enough, there was the chemistry set. But in the corner of his room was a telescope. Now, in real terms, fraction of your salary, telescopes are about 10 times cheaper today than they were back then. So they're very rare back then. And I was fascinated by this telescope. Hadn't seen one up close. I wanted to know what he could see through it. He told me the moon and Jupiter. And I remember saying, oh, can I come down tonight when it's dark and we'll have a look at it? He said, no, Jupiter's gone. I said, where did it go? So I got obsessed with the telescope. And eventually, I think we did look at the chemistry set, because I do remember getting a chemistry set for Christmas. And he told me there were books in the school library about astronomy. In the school library, there's a book called The Universe, and it explained how small the Earth was compared to the Sun. You'd have to squash a million Earths together to make the Sun. And then it showed on the next page how tiny the Sun was compared to some giant stars. And on the next page, it showed how tiny those giant stars were compared to some of the biggest stars in the universe. And it dawned on me that we were insignificant and there was a lot more out there in the universe than they were telling us at school. And I was just flabbergasted at this. Why aren't they telling us this? And it just got me hooked. And I've been that way ever since.
So you took that hooked and you took it to a passion of astronomy. And obviously you went about and got your own telescopes and made a living out of it. How did Astronomy Ireland come around?
Well, we wanted to set up a group that was very much for the general public, not for the people who already have giant telescopes and know almost everything about astronomy, even the serious amateur astronomers, but just actually the main target of our membership is people who have no interest in astronomy because they're missing out, and we've got to tell them about it. There's a whole universe out there that created every single atom and subatomic particle in their being. And it's the ultimate subject. We know so much about the universe, and people go around in their everyday lives not knowing this. So that's to try and communicate that enthusiasm about what's out there is what we're really all about. So if you have no interest in astronomy, you're the one we want to join Astronomy Ireland. And people who have a slight interest, and who doesn't? Even people who say they don't, you can always get them on. Well, where did you think you came from? And it starts an interesting conversation. So doing that, we actually fairly quickly became the world's most popular astronomy club. So we got the level of interest in Ireland up to unprecedented levels. We have thousands of paid up members and roughly 100,000 people in Ireland following us on social media, email lists, that kind of keeping in touch, as it were. And they must count astronomy as at least one of their hobbies, if not their main hobby. And this makes Ireland a hotbed for studying space. And when you look back at our history, that's not surprising. We all just watched Newgrange recently and how the Sunrise Point lines up with that 200,000-ton monument built in the Stone Age without a single metal implement. I mean, they must have been very serious about studying the sky if they built something probably equal to us with modern technology building Dublin City. Why did they put so much effort into it? Because they discovered some very interesting facts. They were the first people exploring the cosmos, as it were. And that's over 5,000 years ago. So it must be in the Irish genes. In the 1840s, we had the biggest telescope in the world. We just launched James Webb Space Telescope that we're going to talk about. Well, the Irish built that in 1845, its equivalent, and actually invited astronomers from around the world. I know they came from New Zealand, the far side of the planet, to look through this telescope. And we had that for over half of a century. And even today, Irish astronomers have helped build the James Webb Space Telescope and the next giant telescope on the ground, which dwarfs the James Webb Space Telescope, is being built by a consortium of countries, including Ireland. So the world's most popular astronomy club, cutting-edge researchers in Ireland, and an incredible history that no other country on the planet has for space exploration.
And of course, down in Birr Castle, where that telescope was, the large telescope was, we have the radio telescope that's part of the ESA interferometry, isn't it?
We do indeed, led by Professor Peter Gallagher, now from the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies. Peter, when he was a teenager, used to come to our public lectures, our monthly lectures in Dublin, went on to get his PhD up at Queen's, went to the USA, worked for NASA for a while, came back to Ireland, and he's the top-ranking astronomer, research astronomer in the whole country. And we've got lots of nice little stories like that about young people who've gone on to do PhDs with Stephen Hawking and the like. So it's great to have an astronomy community that people can get involved in. Because one of the reasons we set up Astronomy Ireland is because as a kid, there was no astronomy club for me. I end up joining the British Astronomical Association, the only one I heard of across the water. Today, though, you know, we've got a fantastic astronomy society. Everybody gets involved and things have changed a lot.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Recently, you're looking at with the Event Horizon Telescope and that, I mean, they're game changers in terms of how we study the universe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we produce a 48-page full-color magazine every month, very few ads in it, a couple of pages for events we're running. We don't carry commercial ads. And it's almost a crime what we can't squeeze into that magazine every month. The level of discoveries is increasing. I mean, we're close to 8 billion people on the planet. A lot of them are well-educated compared to, say, 200 years ago when there was only 1 billion people on the planet around the time of the Birr Telescope. And so the amount of people working in this area is at least 10,000 full-time research astronomers in the world and millions of amateurs and serious people who are studying astronomy. So look at all the space exploration that's going on as well. The future of the human race is definitely in space. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. The question is it decades, centuries, or millennia away? And the world's richest people will tell you it's decades, not
Elon
centuries.
Musk will have us on Mars.
It's all so exciting.
It really is. I mean, in the last 5 years, the thought of actually going to space has actually become an everyday thing. Okay, not quite yet for ordinary Joe Soaps like myself, but you know, it has to start somewhere. And you had the first commercial crew with SpaceX going up there soon, so you know the cost will start coming down eventually, and you know, suborbital flights just might be attainable to ordinary people.
Absolutely. I mean, Richard Branson is Virgin Galactic has always been saying that, okay, it's $250,000 to get up into space for a few minutes, or just the edge of space. But when they start ferrying several thousand people a year up there, which is his plan, then the cost will come down. Sort of the cost of a world cruise. And there are plenty of people in Ireland who can afford a world cruise. So it will still be for the upper echelons of society. But look at the way air travel opened up over the last century. I mean, 1903, the Wright brothers fly less than the wingspan of a jumbo jet. If you told them 100 years later that there'd be hundreds of people traveling at 500 miles an hour anywhere on the planet, they probably would have thought you were crazy. And yet that's what it came to be. And ticket prices have gone down. Okay, you can get special deals for maybe a euro, but typically they're in the tens of euros now. And when there are millions of people, there's about, I think, between 1 and 2 million people in the sky on airplanes at any one moment. And when that's the same with space travel, it'll cost just the price of the fuel.
Tomorrow, if you got the opportunity to go, would you go?
I've applied 3 times this year to be an astronaut. Not the first time I've applied. It was much rarer in the past. Like you say, the pace is picking up. In 1991, there was a full-page ad in the Irish Times, astronaut wanted, no experience necessary. Now, unfortunately, it was for 6 jobs in the European Space Agency, actually 12 jobs originally, and there were, I think, 25,000 applications. So in Ireland, there were 700. I was in the last 15, but didn't get to the last 4, unfortunately, and none of the last 4 were selected in the end. Ireland has such a tiny stake in the European Space Agency. But there were jobs advertised this year. We were promoting heavily on our social media and in the magazine earlier this year. So hopefully lots of people applied. Maybe one of them, including me, I was one of them, might actually get one of the European Space Agency jobs. They're a bit like hen's teeth at the moment, but in the number of jobs is going to increase. The quote I like to tell people is Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, last year they've been vying for the richest person in the world. Both of them have space companies. Both of them were kids fascinated by space who have now gone back to their sort of hobby and trying to commercialize it. And they have jointly said on stage together at a big conference that they are going to put 1 million people on Mars by the end of this century. Now, no one's been to Mars. The moon is very close compared to Mars. So if it was anybody else said that, you'd think they were crackpots. But these guys are the richest people in the world, and they've got the space companies to do it. And if you watch Elon Musk in particular very closely, he's building this 100-seater ferry craft for Mars that's going to go around the moon first. And he is chomping at the bit to get this thing launched. There was just an announcement there recently that they've been delayed by the Federal Aviation Authority to do some tests before you can actually launch the next stage of testing this. They are going to keep building this thing in anticipation of getting the approval to go ahead. The level of the pace at which he's powering towards Mars is absolutely phenomenal. Most of the governments are saying 2030s we might get to Mars. He's saying 2020s. And he is now the richest man in the world. So you've sort of got to stand up and take note. What does he know that we don't?
Could you imagine if you had someone like him running like a country space program? You know, how far would you get with someone like that? I don't think he ever would, but just
don't get me started on politics. But if he was running a country space program, it might not be good thing.
maybe not. So anyway, you have a love for astronomy. Who's your astronomy hero?
Gosh, well, of course, I grew up with Patrick Moore watching the sky at night on BBC long before we had Discovery Channel, National Geographic, and the rest of them, or the internet. And I think Patrick published 150 books. And the great thing about being editor of a magazine like Astronomy Ireland is that, first of all, you have to keep abreast of everything that's going on. This is fantastic for me. It's a dream come true. But you also get to meet lots of people because you're officially a journalist. So I got to meet Patrick Moore. We brought him over for several public lectures in Ireland. I used to do a monthly show on the Den back with Dustin and Ray Darcy. And we had Patrick on the show. And ultimately, the Sky at Night program, still running today now, Chris Lintock and Maggie Darren Pocock, the main presenters, it had its 50th anniversary. And it was the world's longest running TV show with the same presenter in 2007. And he very kindly invited us over to the filming and the party over 2 days. We stayed in his house, or near his house in at the south coast of England. The BBC brought all the equipment, big marquee. And there was an incredible number of people there, from one of the cheeky girls to all the country's basic research astronomers. And I'm going to get back to Patrick Moore in a second, but this tells you a little bit about what the vision for Astronomy Ireland is. The one thing that I noticed is we had brought across a lot of these people was Celtic Tiger 2007. So we had actually got funding to bring we basically went to the heads of departments of all the universities doing astronomy in England, brought them over to give public lectures in Dublin. So I knew a lot of them. We had drinks, pints with them afterwards. And I was renewing old acquaintances and saying, oh yeah, of course, over the last 50 years, you've been on Patrick's show, The Sky at Night, I'm sure. And they said, yes. Almost to a man and woman. Yes, I have been on the show, but that's not why I'm here. When I was a kid, I wrote to Patrick and he kindly sent me back a lovely letter that inspired me to keep up my interest in astronomy. And Patrick was known for that. He would get hundreds of letters a week and he would sit down with an ancient typewriter, even in the 21st century, and hand type out a reply letter. And that has inspired so many people. It made me realize his legacy is not the 50-year TV show he did. It's not the 150 books. It is the billions, maybe even trillions, that he has contributed to the UK economy by inspiring young people to keep up at least an interest in science in general, if not astronomy in particular. And that's what, when Astronomy Ireland reached 25, we realized that's what we want to do. We want to inspire the young people in particular. Yeah, we'll do all of our events for the older people and tell everyone about astronomy. But in particular, to inspire the young people, especially now that Ireland's economy has shifted radically. And we are now a huge science-based economy with one of the biggest GDPs per capita in the world. We beat the UK. We beat the USA. The only people that are bigger than us are the countries that are sitting on vast oil reserves. And there's even a chance in the future Ireland could become the Saudi Arabia of energy in the future, using things like wind power. Turns out we do have a natural resource that we didn't really realize, but you know, I'm going off topic.
No, it's okay. It's all science.
There. Patrick is my hero and always has been. And to get to spend time with him and have him drink me under the table on more than one occasion was an absolute delight.
He was a good character, wasn't he? He was
an amazing character. The British had a way of producing people like you. You might remember, well, we all know, yeah, David Attenborough. You might remember Magnus Pike, Patrick Moore, etc. They were these larger than life
Murray Walker from the F1. It was just kind of...
Yeah, just almost crazy people, but carrying a serious message.
I think you need a few nutcases in a mix just to make things a little bit more interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, just on, was it Christmas Day? The James Webb Telescope was launched. And
yes, and so far everything's going well. The launch went well. There are something like 300 different little motors, actuators that have to work to unfurl all the telescope, because it's the size of a tennis court and you can't fit something that big into the nose cone of a rocket. So they folded it all up as tightly as they could. And now the only problem is in space, they've got to unfurl it. And we've had problems with this in the past. The Galileo spacecraft on its way out to Jupiter had a big antenna, big radio dish to beam its pictures back to Earth, and it failed to unfold. And in the end, they had to use a very backup, to very weak transmitter, and rejig all the software to compress the pictures and data as much as possible. And they managed to cobble something together out of the mission, but it didn't have its one single high-gain antenna because one pin stuck. And when they were trying to unfurl it, and I said this to some of the engineers working on the telescope, they had a conference over in Ireland because I said there's Irish involvement with this telescope. And I said, you're not worried about how many things can go wrong. Surely the chances of everything working to unfurl this telescope is practically nil. And he said, well, we have had experience in the past. And that's when I realized, oh yes, it's Northrop Grumman, who are a huge military contractor. And I said that to him, and I said, ah, yes, your military contracts. You've done things like this before, unfurling things in space. And it was one of those moments where he smiled. It was one of the sort of things, yes, I can tell you what we've done, but then I'd have to shoot you.
Very good.
So we're hopeful that this is not the first time they've done this kind of thing. So far, things are unfurling well. Let's just hope all goes to plan. I mean, remember the Hubble Space Telescope, its predecessor, and then they found out the mirror was made to exactly
the wrong.
They
needed to get a pair of spectacles.
That doesn't happen. Yeah. So we're all hopeful. All we do is assume that it's going to work well. Irish involvement, as I said, in one of the infrared instruments on board, which is critical for looking back at the ancient universe. And in fact, our New Year public lecture on January 10 is by one of the Irish researchers who's worked on the James Webb Space Telescope. So almost literally from the horse's mouth, we're going to find out about James Webb and what his hope is.
What is the Irish team that's worked on that?
Well, it's led by Professor Tom Ray at the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies. And they've done some work on the cameras that they're going to use on James Webb are going to look in the infrared more than the visible. So Hubble worked in the visible light that we can see and ultraviolet, shorter wavelengths that we can't see. But it turns out that if you want to see what's going on in the early universe, soon after the Big Bang, the further back in time you look, or this more distant you look, the universe is expanding, and the faster those objects are rushing away from you. And that causes a redshift. That means that the light of bright stars, which would normally be visible to us, shifts over into the red, and then beyond that, into the infrared, where we can't even see it. And Hubble wasn't built for that. Hubble was, its main purpose was to find out the age of the universe, and it did that quite well. Lots of other things to do as well, but that was its main purpose. James Webb, its main purpose is to look at the early universe, the very first stars that were born. Computer simulations suggest they should have been monsters, a million times brighter than the sun, maybe even brighter. And we don't see many of those stars around today. But they were probably all like that in the early universe. And what did that do to the universe? I mean, we can speculate, do computer simulations, or we can build James Webb and have a look and see what was going on. So that's its main thing. And so these infrared instruments are very important. You have to put little filters in front of them to section out part of the spectrum of light. The scientist will explain all this to you. He's going to explain all this at the New Year public lecture. It's online, so everyone can watch it. And the Irish... So these filters are going into a $10 billion telescope. They have got to be done right. They've got to be the cutting edge of technology. And DS has that capability. And I've heard some talk about it before, but I'm looking forward to finding out all the fine details on January the 10th. And we've told them that he's talking to the general public. So it's not a science lesson. It's about, you know, how can we explain the kind of crazy, cutting-edge, world-class research we do to people who've never even studied science for the leading sir.
And as you said there, that this telescope is a $10 billion telescope. And I've had been keeping my eye on this and hoping it would launch for the better part of 10 years. And I know it goes back longer than that. So this thing has been tested. So hopefully, fingers crossed, it all goes well.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, it's amazing how you can put together a project like that with thousands of scientists and engineers and get it launched and then get it unfurled, etc. Even just the logistics of doing all that is a major achievement, let alone the kind of science that's going to come out of it. But it's, you know, it's 20 years in the planning. They just announced recently that they're going to start thinking about its successor, because that probably won't fly till time to start thinking about it, because these projects take about 20 years and $10 billion as well. Of course, James Webb is hopelessly over budget, hopelessly delayed. It was cancelled by Congress in the US at one stage. It's a joint project of the Europeans, Americans, and Canadians, including the Irish, of course, because we're Europeans. And the story behind James Webb, even before it was launched, is worthy of a book.
And tell me this, when they park this thing, they're parking this out at the L2 point. I don't know if you want to explain what the L2 point is, but is there any chance that this will change the way we view the universe? Are they going to look back and say, well, hold on a minute, we're not seeing 13.8 billion years, we can actually see further back, the universe is a lot older than we think. Is that possible?
We are limited to 13.8 billion years because that is the physical age of the universe, and it means that, you know, 14 billion, 15 billion, there was nothing there, possibly not even including time. But that's a question for another interview. But the James Webb itself will see nearly that far back, about 13 billion years. And for future physicists, because they are working on this, it's just a very tricky area. The 13.8 billion is the moment the Big Bang happened. So the first 400,000 years, the universe is way too hot for even a single atom to exist. Then it cools down after that over the next few million years. And eventually you can form atoms, mostly hydrogen, and they form giant clouds of gas. About 3/4 was hydrogen, 1/4 was helium, and almost nothing else. No other big atoms like we see mostly lying around on the Earth. Stars had to make those in their cores later on. So we've got these huge clouds of hydrogen and helium gas, and under gravity they fall together, and we think they produce giant stars. They light up, and they're extremely bright, and the universe is full of light from stars. And that's roughly what we think happened. You can simulate this in computers more accurately, but we don't know the exact parameters that started the whole thing off, so you can have different computer simulation outcomes. So the James Webb Space Telescope will start to pick up the light of those stars probably a few hundred million years after the Big Bang happened. So 13.5 billion years ago to 13 billion years ago. That's what it should see. It won't be able to see anything before that because there was nothing to see before that. And we live in this crazy expanding universe. Yeah, as I was saying, We give the, a talk. I give a talk called "The Universe" in theaters around the country. Well, it used to before COVID, theaters around the country and in schools as well. And the analogy I like to use to people to explain that the Big Bang isn't a bang; it's more of a stretching. Is that the average house is sitting in space, and the space it's in is actually stretching. So imagine the house sitting on a big rubber sheet, and somebody's pulling the rubber sheet, and so the rubber sheet below it is stretching. Of course, if your house was anchored to that rubber sheet, your house would rip apart. And that is what will happen to the universe in the future. But at the moment, the house only moves about the width of one atom every year. So you're not going to notice that stretching of space-time. It's only when we look over the vast distances to galaxies that we can actually see it becoming kilometers per second. And we can measure that using a trick called spectroscopy. So one day, though, the universe will stretch at 2 atoms a year. On a scale of a house, then 10 atoms a year, and then 1 million atoms a year. We know the universe expansion is speeding up. And so we'll end up, ultimately, space will be ripping itself apart and not even atoms can exist. The sort of good news is that's going to happen in such a distant future. Even saying millions and trillions of times the age of the universe at present is not far enough into the future. It's a ridiculously far point into the future. So it's crazy that we, from our current measurements and theories, we think the universe is going to rip itself apart in the very long distant future, which means there is no meaning to existence or reality at all. It's all going to be gone at some stage in the future, unless somebody finds some science that explains that this is only a temporary thing, or it's a feature of the universe that will change in the future, which we just don't know yet. A bit scary at the moment, though.
It's a bit too far in the future, I think, for us to worry about it. Tell me this, why are they parking the Webb telescope at the L2 point?
Yes. Well, the Hubble Space Telescope sort of hugs the Earth. It's only 500 kilometers or so above the Earth's surface. So the Earth is just below it, very bright, and of course, very hot when you're on the sunny side. And you don't want an infrared telescope that can pick up heat that close to the Earth. So you have to get it out into space, well away from the Earth, pointing exactly opposite from the sun in the sky as well. And it turns out there's this sweet point about 1 million miles from the Earth where the Earth's gravity balances the gravity of the sun. And if you put an object out there, it will stay there. You don't need to keep boosting it with a rocket motor to keep it in place. So it turns out that is fantastic. It means that you can be sitting there 1 million miles from the Earth. So as long as you're not facing the Earth or the sun, it's actually the sun and the Earth are both sort of behind you. So you just look in the opposite direction. You can see it into the cold depths of space. And that's where they're going to put the James Webb Space Telescope, meaning that it'll be able to see really faint objects, really cold objects, like the light that stretched all the way from just after the Big Bang. It unfortunately means we won't be able to get up and service it like we did with the Hubble Space Telescope, which is now going over 30 years and can be serviced, or at least used to be able to be serviced with the space shuttle. But James Webb, maybe with future technology, they could invent some kind of service and mission. But remember, there's been nobody 1 million miles from the Earth ever. The astronauts went to the moon last in 1972, only got 250,000 miles away. So we're going to need some significant technology if we ever want to service it. It might actually be cheaper just to build a new one than to actually grab James Webb.
And, you know, obviously with infrared, we should be able to take pictures through dust clouds of galaxies and nebulas and all that. Do you think the Webb will be able to return images, like the pillars of creation that Hubble has done, or the deep field in truly spectacular, breathtaking pictures?
Absolutely. I mean, the primary mission, James Webb, is to look at the early universe and figure out how all star formation got going. But it is a general purpose telescope and has got a suite of projects. Another thing you can do is look at planets going around other stars. Now, we can detect them using tricks on the Earth and with space telescopes, but to actually image them directly is very, very difficult. But James Webb is brilliant at this because of its size and because of its infrared capability. So that's going to revolutionize our understanding of planets going around other stars, but it can do almost everything else as well. So there are astronomers the world over queuing up to use this telescope. And what they've said is, the heads of the program itself have said, what's going to be interesting, there's roughly a 10-year period that James Webb should last for at least, is it's going to be the things that we didn't expect to discover that will be its most amazing legacy. And so we're very excited about all the things it can do, but we're in 10 years' time when we do this interview again, I think we'll have a couple of things it did well, and then a whole load of things that we just did not expect. And that's going to be the excitement.
Mm. You touched on its ability to look at planets. And obviously the last mission to look at the planets was the Kepler telescope, which was extraordinarily successful in spotting transits throughout the suns. So how will this telescope, the Webb telescope, will be able to directly image planets? Is that correct?
Yes.
So with that, they'll be able to, I suppose, through spectroscopy, look at the light of the atmospheres?
Yes, it will. And from space, any telescope is going to get a much sharper view anyway. One of the reasons for putting Hubble up, that and the ultraviolet light that you can't see from down on the ground. But James Webb is a 6.5 meter wide mirror. Hubble's only 2.4. So the resolving power is nearly 3 times greater, which means you see 9 times more detail. As well as that, it's doing infrared. Stars tend to emit a lot of their light as brighter light, shorter wavelengths than infrared. Planets emit mostly infrared. So the sort of balance of the fraction of light at infrared wavelengths that exoplanets have is better. So it's ideally suited to see sharper detail and just in the right kind of spectrum where exoplanets can be seen. We already have a few pictures of planets orbiting stars. So there's going to be some that where conditions are just right, that the big planet is far enough away from the star that we can actually see it. We've published pictures like that in Astronomy Island magazine in the past, but not many of them. James Webb will be able to do a lot more. And also where we think, you know, we predict where the planet should be, we can go and see, can we actually see them where we think they should be to make sure we're getting all this science right? So as I said, the exoplanet community is chomping at the bit to use the James Webb Space Telescope. It'll take about a month for it to get to where it's going, get assembled, as it were, and start taking its first images. And by the summer, we should have some amazing results back.
Mm. Can't wait for that now, to be perfectly honest with you. Will the Webb Telescope, will it change science? What is there anything that they're hoping to prove or disprove with this?
Well, I'm sure it will, but I can't tell you what it is because we just don't know yet. The first thing is we're rather sketchy on the details of what happened after the Big Bang cooled down enough to make the first atoms, to make the first matter in the universe. There's all this dark matter around. We still don't know what it is, but we can measure it and detect its presence. And it's very important in the early universe as to how it sets up the universe. So the one thing it has to do is, it turns out it's not very uniformly spread. It's sort of filamentary in structure. And these slight density variations, where it's a little bit denser than normal, are the seeds of where galaxies come from. So once, if we can see what's going on in the very early universe, it will really firm up our theories of how the universe evolved back then. To be honest, after about probably the first 1 billion years, it's all pretty fairly straightforward. It's just gravity doing its thing. So how the first stars form, they have to be these monsters that are 100, 200, 300 times the mass of the sun, glowing 1 to 10 million times brighter than the sun. That there are a very few of those stars nearby that we can actually look at and study. They don't live very long. They burn up their fuel so fast, they probably live of the order of 1 million years compared to the sun's 10,000 million years. They're like rock stars. They shine bright and die young. So exactly how that the early universe worked, we hope James Webb will tell us. And that will be a very important piece of the jigsaw, how the universe got here. It may discover something we totally did not expect and really revolutionize our understanding of astronomy. It might just confirm what the computer simulations say.
If you could put together a project on the scale of James Webb, what would you like to see?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'd be a bit biased because my own personal interests are more mundane. We all love the cosmology and where do we all come from and what's the meaning of life. But I've always been interested in comets. So I would always love to have a suite of telescopes in the sky that can see comets anywhere, anytime, because we're following one in the southern hemisphere at the moment. It was in the northern hemisphere. I saw it a few times, got some pictures of it in early December. And then it sort of dived down into the southern skies. They can see it from equatorial and southern hemisphere locations. And the pictures that are coming back are absolutely incredible. The tail of this comet is now, and it's getting longer, about 60 degrees long. What does that mean? Well, the plow, if you know the plow in the sky, it's roughly 25 degrees from the left-handmost star to the right-handmost star. The tail of the thing's twice as long as that and growing and still not as close as to the sun. It's called Comet Leonard. So it's proving to be a fantastic comet. Not particularly big comet, came fairly close to the Earth, and it's going to go fairly close to the sun, about Venus distance, get really heated up, which will set all kinds of shenanigans going on in these giant icy snowballs. So comets was sort of what inspired me. In 1986, I went to Australia just to see Halley's Comet. It won't be back till 2061. So that's maybe an obsession I have. But there are plenty of research astronomers who have really interesting ideas. You mentioned the Event Horizon Telescope that's looking at directly at black holes, which is an incredible feat and really cutting edge technology as well. Some amazing things you can do with radio astronomy. We can see much finer detail than we can with optical astronomy. They're building the 39 meter extremely large European telescope in Chile. They've already cut the top off the mountain, laid the foundations. The mirrors are being made. I think it's in Italy. Everything's been shipped to Chile. And in, I think it's 2 to 3 years, we should be looking through that. Now, remember, James Webb is a 6.5 meter wide mirror. This thing's 39 meters wide. And they've got technology now that can get rid of the shimmering effect of the Earth's atmosphere and almost make those telescopes as good as space telescopes. That only costs just over $1 billion compared to James Webb's $10 billion. Imagine we built 10 of them instead of one James Webb Space Telescope. So there are all manner of projects that you could dream about. The subject is just so vast. It's what I love. I mean, I tell new people coming into the hobby, you know, you can be interested in this for the maths and the science if you're a science type person, yeah. But everything in between, right the way down to pure art. Some of the pictures they make of the telescopes and from the Hubble Space Telescope, in my opinion, are much better than modern art pictures with a bit of paint across the canvas.
I cannot agree more with you. I mean, you see some of the pictures coming out, and even some of the pictures you have from the Mars missions on Mars at the minute, they're just absolutely stunning. And, you know, to think that human beings, you know, have developed these tools, you know, to help us see and understand the universe far beyond what we can at the minute, it really is breathtaking.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I love about the position I stumbled into is that, you know, we haven't been able to physically bring anybody across for a talk to Ireland recently, of course, but we will in the future, and we'll still be doing them online because we're a 32 county organization, always have been, always will be. But after the talk, you get to take these people for a pint afterwards and, you know, talk to them about all manners of things. And these are people that are working on James Webb Space Telescope. They're working on $200 million missions with hundreds of other scientists and thousands of engineers scattered all across the world. And this is their day-to-day job. You know, and that's their life. They do one project, maybe two in their lifetime. And I get to talk to them and their colleagues and other people. You talk to everybody doing space telescopes, astronauts. I've met countless astronauts from Neil Armstrong to Buzz Aldrin and all the way down. And it's great almost being sort of a jack of all trades and master of none. I leave the mastering to them, and we'll just, after 20 years, they'll have a few end results that they can put on one page of paper to show for 20 years' work. And I can read that one and then read their 10,000 colleagues' resumes as well and know a bit about everything. And that's what always fascinated me. When I went to college to do astrophysics, I ended up getting sidetracked into IT. Because there were more jobs in IT and they were much better paid at the time. And so I ended up in IT. And I sort of realized I didn't want to spend decades just studying one particular area of astronomy in extreme detail to contribute to the sum total of human knowledge. That's a research astronomer. I wanted to be this jack of all trades and know a bit about everything and do my own little astronomy with a pair of binoculars or a telescope, which are dirt cheap these days. You get a good pair of binoculars for 20 quid today. And you don't even need binoculars to see shooting stars and the like. So I'm an amateur astronomer, not a research astronomer.
But you're an amateur astronomer who's basically living your dream, for sure. I mean, you get to nerd out with all these great people. And,
I mean, you know, if you get to write
and talk about it.
If you told me when I was a nerdy little scientist at UCD that one day I'd be sitting down having coffee and a chat with Neil Armstrong about him walking around on the surface of the moon and his Irish ancestry, by the way, he's Irish, very Irish. And he's proud to be Irish, but he passed away, unfortunately. Buzz Aldrin as well. And then I've met Stephen Hawking, Brian Cox, Patrick Moore, David Attenborough, a whole host of scientists, and even a bunch of celebrities who have an interest in this as well. Chris de Burgh is a big fan of astronomy. If you look at our webpage, see a picture of me and him trying to talk to the then Mir space station before the IAS. And think of all the people, artists who have been inspired by the universe, from Coldplay writing stars about songs about Sky Full of Stars to, you know, Starry Night, was it Van Gogh? Everybody, you go out into a dark sky and you look up, and if you are not inspired, you do not have a soul.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my neighbors here would probably call me a little bit strange sometimes. They'll see me just outside looking up, and just sometimes just to calm my head, I'll just go out and just look up at the sky just to calm down. I have to ask, what was Neil Armstrong like?
That was a phenomenal experience. I was so nervous going to meet him. He had been booked to give it. He hadn't given many public talks after his moonshots and the world tour they did. He sort of became a bit of a recluse. He wasn't so much a recluse as he just didn't want to the public engagement that way. But he remarried, the story goes, and his new wife convinced him to go out and talk more. And he did. And I think he was doing 6 public appearances a year. And he was booked to talk in Dublin, and we were helping to promote the event. So the sort of, what's the word? The fee we got was an interview one-on-one with Neil Armstrong. So we asked all of our members, what questions have you got? And one of the questions, so we asked him the usual stuff, and I'm sure he's bored answering all those. You can actually watch there's a beautiful YouTube video, I think, when he did a talk in New Zealand of the actual landing. He goes through all that. But the big thing for me, one of the questions was, I thought Armstrong, back then, it's 2003, we didn't know Tom Cruise was Irish. We didn't know Barack Obama was Irish and all these kind of things. But I thought Armstrong sounds Scottish to me. He's probably got some Scotch ancestry in him there somewhere. And so I just asked him casually, have you any Irish ancestry? At that point, he lit up in the interview and he said, yes, in fact, we have just recently done our family tree. And it turns out the Armstrongs came from County Fermanagh.
Really?
And then he laughed and said, yeah, in fact, they were known for stealing cattle. So I remember when I was doing my history back in school, there was a little entry about 1969, Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. But it didn't say he was descended from ancient Irish cattle rustlers.
that's a really, really, you know, that's an interesting story. And, you know, it's only an Irish person who would get that out of him, you know.
We asked Buzz Aldrin the same question. And Buzz is an incredible character. He can be very difficult at times. I've seen him on interviews online around the world, and he will, if the conversation is not going his way, he will let you know and change it. Neil was much, much more demure and he was actually a bit nervous being interviewed, to be honest. Buzz Aldrin, when asking that question, the Irish answer, no, that was it. So we moved on to the next question.
Our solar system, more the planets that we can look at. Obviously, I have a telescope. My favorite planet to look at is Saturn. I just find it gorgeous. But do you think we will find life in our solar system, and where? If you do?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, because life is one of the main things that NASA has said they're looking for. They want their mission statement at the moment. It's really looking for life. They're going to do lots of other things as well, but life is very high on the list of priorities. And the whole idea of life in our solar system really opened up enormously in the last decade or two, because we all thought Mars back in the 60s, before the first spacecraft got there, people were seeing little dark patches on Mars moving around. I've seen clouds on Mars in my own telescope from Ireland, and the best telescopes thought they could see the dark patches growing in the marsh in summer when the ice cap melted and shrinking back, which was exactly what vegetation would do. So in the 1800s, when they were building the first big giant telescopes, they were all pretty convinced, well, there's plant life on Mars, we can see that. And then some people thought they saw thin lines crisscrossing the surface, and some even thought they were artificial waterways, canals. And of course, back then, late 1800s, they just started building giant canals on the Earth, the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal, things that we're all very proud of our technology. But on Mars, the canals were 10 to 100 times longer and wider. So the Martians were obviously a lot more advanced than we were. And 1898, when H.G. Wells wrote his famous book, The War of the Worlds, he was just dramatizing one of the scientific theories of the day, which is, we all know there's plant life on Mars, and there's probably intelligent life there, and they're a lot more advanced than us, so they can see this lovely, watery planet, whereas they live on a desert world. So why wouldn't they have rockets that could come to Earth and be rubbing their hands with glee, thinking about getting rid of those pesky Earthlings so we can take over the planet? The 60s, that theory was dashed when the Mariner spacecraft sent back pictures showing Mars is barren, it's covered in craters, there's no plant life, it's just dark patches on the surface, probably where there's no sand. The sand is being blown around in the Martian seasons. That's what appears to change the dark markings. Nothing interesting at all. And then people have clung on to the idea there might be life there. Well, you know, we know for the first billion years of its life, it was like the Earth, it had oceans. And so life should have got started, because it certainly got started on that time scale on the Earth. And the question is, did it all die out then when the oceans vanished? Or did it manage to eke out a miserable existence below the surface and didn't evolve like the Earth, like the life on the Earth did? And that's what they're still looking for. Are there at least fossils from that first billion years? And is there any way there can be any even microbes still somewhere below the surface that one day we might find? So I don't think Mars is a likely target for finding life. But then we find that the moons of Jupiter, which are not like our moon, our moon's sort of rock. Jupiter's moons are sludge, which is mostly water with rocky materials mixed in. And the gravity of the moons pulling on each other and Jupiter pulling on them flexes the whole moon. It happens a little bit on the moon, our moon. It actually happens on the Earth. That's what causes our tides. But it's much worse on the moons of Jupiter. And it turns out it's melted the sludge. So all the rock has shrunk to this core, and the liquid water is floating on top. And of course, it's a lot further than the sun than we are, so it's freezing cold where the out part of the moon touches space. So that's frozen into a nice shell. So you've got the shell of ice, a deep ocean, and a rocky core. And that ocean is warm. It's got organic compounds in it, and it's probably got volcanic vents like we have on the Earth, which is where we think life probably formed on the Earth. And it's been running that way for 4 billion years. So life got started very soon on the Earth doing that. So it must have got started on Jupiter's moons. Io was a bit too close to the effects, too much. It actually turns into volcanoes. But Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto have probably got oceans. Europa, it's small compared to the Earth, about a quarter of the width of the Earth, but it's got, its oceans are so deep, 100 kilometers, that it's got twice as much water in its oceans than the Earth does. So there has to be life in the oceans of Europa. Or we're wrong, or we're missing something about how we think life got started on the Earth. And then we go out to Saturn, even further out, even colder, and it turns out there's plumes of water being spat out by a tiny moon that's only 500 kilometers across. We're talking the size of the British Isles. That's crazy. And now Titan, its giant moon, as big as the planet Mercury, has probably got liquid oceans below its surface. So if it turns out that there is life on the moons of these outer planets, and on Mars, and on the Earth, it means life can start almost anywhere, and the whole universe must be teeming with at least microbes. We're actually just recently finished a three-part documentary series on life in the universe, interviewing astronomers from around the world. It's going out on RTE Radio 1 in March. If you want to know exactly when, date hasn't been set yet. Follow Astronomy on social media. We'll be screaming all about that then.
Absolutely. So you count yourself as an amateur astronomer, right? So you go out to the night sky. What's your favorite target to look at, or do you have one?
Well, as I said, I got a bit into the photography and comets in particular. There's always a few faint comets around you. You can barely record a smudges, and then every maybe year or two, you get a giant one. I mean, in 2019, we had, during the lockdowns, we had this huge comet that was well-placed in the northern hemisphere for once. It was as bright as the brightest stars in the sky, with a tail arcing about the length of the plough. Beautiful sight. I remember sitting there once on the bonnet of the car, out in the countryside, arms folded, just looking at it and marveling at a bright comet for once, because I think we were waiting about 10 years since we had one like that. Now they're getting that in the southern hemisphere. Actually, it's not even as bright as the one we had in 2019. So comets I love. But you mentioned Saturn there. And the one thing I remember is, one of the things that made Astronomy On famous, got us big, was always setting up telescopes for the general public to come and have a look at them. And we do one huge event every year, biggest star party in Ireland. It's actually its 30th anniversary next year in 2022. And it's called Starbecue, a barbecue under the stars. We go up to the Wicklow Mountains, invite people with big telescopes to come along and let the general public look through them with a professionally catered barbecue, a few talks just in case it's cloudy. We'll repeat the telescopes the following week to make sure people get a look through them. And when Saturn's on view, and it will be this summer, August 27th, they see, we can point Saturn in the sky. There it is, brightest star, nothing special looking about it with the naked eye. Here it is in the telescope. Now it's a big ball, a globe with its rings around it. And people sometimes step back, look at the side of the telescope and say, have you got a projector inside that telescope showing that image? No, that's Saturn live. It is, in a good telescope, by far the most breathtaking sight there is. The second one is the moon. I've been looking at the moon for decades, and you still look at it with your telescope. There's never any clouds on the moon, so you can always see the surface in fine detail. And because of the way the shadows fall from all the craters and mountains, it never looks the same every day. It never gets old. And I remember being on the side of the road occasionally, and the Gardaí might pull up beside you and ask you what you're up to. And you say, oh, look at the moon or whatever. And once you show them, they're all full of questions as well. So the moon, I think, if you've got even a pair of binoculars will show the craters, and a small telescope you can get less than 100 quid will show you superbly. Watch the moon every chance that you get. And we use that actually, because the moon will pass by the bright planets. And if you don't know which star, in quotes, is a planet, well, when the moon's near it, it's signposting it for you. So we always put in the magazine when the moon is near Jupiter or Saturn or Mars. And people can then, if they don't know the sky, say, well, there's the moon. I know the moon. And then that bright object above it, it's actually planet Jupiter. And then they know where Jupiter is, and they can watch that for the following few months.
Tell me this, for beginners getting into astronomy, what's the best advice that you can give them?
Well, it'll sound like I'm biased, but if you read any of Patrick Moore's books, he always said this: join your astronomy society. Because first of all, you're in good company. You're with thousands of other people who are interested in the same thing. And that will keep your interest up. The magazine, we have a weekly email that goes out, which updates members as well, will definitely keep you abreast of what's happening in the sky and what's happening around Ireland, or any events, any talks you can listen to online or even go to, and the astronauts coming to Ireland to speak, all that kind of thing. So join Astronomy Ireland is the first thing. Astronomy.ie, you need to look no further than there. And that'll cost you about €1 a week. So not the end of the world. Most stuff is done by volunteers, so it keeps the price way down. There are American and British magazines you can get that'll cost you nearly twice as much, and they don't do all the events that we do as well. So at least support your local astronomy club. There's free social media. You definitely should be on that. That's the first thing. So the next thing you do, if you want to get into the hobby, and only about a half of the people do this, where they go outside in the cold and look up, get yourself a pair of binoculars. And the best pair to get are 10 by 50 binoculars. And so you'll see it written on the side, 10x50. The 10x means 10 times. That's how many times they magnify. And the 50 is the size of the front lens in millimeters. The wider that is, the more light it's collecting, and stuffing into your eye, and therefore the brighter the images will be, the better look you'll get. And a pair of 10 by 50 binoculars is nearly 100 times better than your eyesight. That is a huge jump. You need to jump from a pair of binoculars to the biggest telescope in Ireland to get the equivalent jump. So you're taking a big jump down the road, and you can get those for as little as 20 quid these days. So a tiny investment. And as long as you look after them, they should last a lifetime. So the actual cost per year is trivial. And you can use them for a daytime, for bird spotting, for landscapes, you know, anything at a horse racing, the lot. So definitely every home should have a pair of 10 by 50 binoculars. No doubt about it. And as I said, telescopes have come down by a factor of 10 in price since I was a kid, because back then they were made in Japan. China wasn't the big manufacturing giant that it is now. And slowly but surely, all the manufacturers moved their manufacturing to China. Now, practically every telescope, sure, practically everything is made in China. So if you're looking at your phone or your laptop, listening to this, it's probably made in China. And the Chinese do make good quality telescopes and binoculars. So the telescope I got in the 70s, you can get a better telescope, higher quality, for a lower price. When you factor in all the inflation from back then, it means they're roughly, in real terms, one-tenth of their cost. So every house should have a telescope as well. Which one to get? There's an awful lot to choose from. If you get stuck, there's some web pages on astronomy.ie will help you. And then not only will we email talk to you that way, but if you're getting really stuck, one of the volunteer members of Astronomy will ring you and talk to you about what you want a telescope for and what the best one to get is.
You can't go wrong, really.
You can't go wrong. Watch with the naked eye, meteor showers, just admiring the cosmos. You just need your eyesight. Pair of binoculars for 20 quid, you've got 100 times better view, and a small telescope. You can spend, for 100 quid, you'll get a good one for looking at the moon. You don't need to spend thousands. 1% of our membership will spend thousands, and usually they take pictures and they send them in for the magazine, so we can all live vicariously through that.
And look, before I let you go, there's just one question I have to ask you. It's just, again, it's the nerdy part of me, and I have you, and I wouldn't say. So you spent a lifetime just looking up at the sky. Have you ever seen anything unidentified while you were out?
I have to ask. That's the thing. No, I haven't. And we are looking at the sky a lot. We get a lot of reports in almost daily at this stage, certainly every week, of people seeing interesting things. So usually things like fireballs, which are very bright meteors shooting stars. They're quite rare, and most people will probably never see one in their lifetime. Well, if you're out watching the sky all the time, you get to see a few every year. So we know what they are, and we can explain them. The International Space Station blazes across the sky. People say, I was out walking the dog last night, and this star just appeared, silent, didn't make any noise, crossed the sky over 2 or 3 minutes, outshone all the stars by a factor of 100. What was that? And the answer is, it's the, well, I used to say only, but Chinese now have one. It's one of the space stations with humans on board. There are astronauts up there at the moment, and there have been since 1991, I think, was the first crew that went. No, sorry, 1998, was it? No, 2001 was the first crew. The first module was launched 1998. So long ago, I'm beginning to forget. So we have people in space all the time now, and you can see it from Ireland. And in fact, at the end of January, I think the 18th onwards, 18th, 19th, 20th, the space station will start flying over in the evening sky, and you'll get free predictions of, there are lots of apps and websites that do it, but the Astronomy Ireland social media will tell you not only when it's flying over, but if it's going to go near the moon and where you need to be in Ireland to see it actually pass in front of the moon. And there's a new craft being launched to chase it across the sky. Nothing like watching the space station with a little dimmer craft chasing after it with either more astronauts on board, or maybe they're leaving the space station, or they're bringing up cargo. So you can watch space exploration happening in the skies above Ireland if you follow our social media.
and with that, where can people get in touch with you if they're interested in joining Astronomy Ireland? How can they get in touch or contact?
Yeah, well, astronomy.ie. I think if you search Astronomy Ireland after 30 odd years, you'll find us anyway. Astronomy.ie, if you can memorize that. You can see the links to social media. If you're on social media, immediately follow us there. If you've got a euro a week to spare, then join Astronomy on, get the magazine, get the emails, and help support the club as well. We're not happy being the world's most popular astronomy club. We want to be 10 times bigger, and we've big plans for that. Follow us and tell your friends. That's the important thing. Don't you just join the club. We want all your friends and family to join as well. We're a very open group. We're looking for new people who are just starting out. We've got evening classes if you want to study at that level. Run twice a year. They start in February and October. And lots of other things. The club just expanded enormously during all the lockdowns because people turned to their hobbies. It's given us a huge financial boost. We've hired staff. And I will say, after our first 30 years, what we are planning in the future, you ain't seen nothing yet. So astronomy.ie, get in on the ground floor.
And just one thing, you have some lectures coming up on the 10th, is it? Where can people watch that?
So our next talk is the New Year public lecture being given by Dr. Patrick Kavanagh, who's in the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, who's working on the James Webb Space Telescope. So almost nobody in the world will know more about it than him. He's going to explain the Irish work that goes on, of course, but also what James Webb is going to do much better than I'm able to explain it. And it's aimed at the general public. So get the whole family around the phone, laptop or TV and tune in on January the 10th. Details are on astronomy.ie. You need to book a ticket in advance in case we sell out. There'll be one of those talks every month by an expert from around the world telling us about their area of interest. There are the evening classes coming up in February. There's the giant barbecue with telescopes on August the 27th. And maybe we'll be able to run some more physical events in the coming months when all the restrictions are gone away, hopefully.
Yeah, and look, membership to Astronomy Ireland, I mean, it would make a great gift as well, wouldn't it?
If you've got a young kid interested in astronomy, you've got to foster that knowledge, because even if they don't end up in academia as a research astronomer, they're going to end up as a scientist or engineer. And about 60% of the Irish economy comes from now all the internet companies, chip manufacturers, pharmaceutical companies, all the science-based. It's 60% of our GDP. There's a good political reason why it's not being pushed to the general public as much. But think of the Celtic Tiger, the construction boom. The construction industry back then in the Celtic Tiger boom year was 20% of GDP. Since that time, when we've been attracting all these companies into Ireland, the science part of our economy is three times higher than the Celtic Tiger was at its peak, and it's continued. So there are about 200,000 really high paid jobs and indeed interesting and future proof jobs there for young people. So if you give them the gift of a membership of the club, we'll keep reminding them every month why this is the hobby to study, science in general, astronomy in particular, and they may end up going on to do their PhD with Stephen Hawking, like a young 12-year-old I remember called Oisin Machanana did, or Peter Gallagher, who's now the professor, the head of the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, and lots of other people in Irish universities around the country. You don't have to become a research astronomer if you join Astronomy Ireland, but you can take it that far, or you can just look at the pretty pictures in the magazine every month.
And look, on that note, David, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. I've learned a good bit about the Webb telescope today. Thank you very much for your time, and look, Happy New Year to you.
My pleasure. And you know what? We haven't even touched one-tenth of the subject today. But that's the great thing about astronomy. So Happy New Year to you too and all the listeners.
Thank you very much.